Good morning. Let's get this party started. So, okay. So the next item on the program is our annual history lecture, and this year we're establishing a new precedent of naming this lecture for Dr. Hal Urschel. Dr. Urschel, as we all know, is a longtime member of the Society, the Southern Thoracic, and someone we all loved, and he touched each and every one of us in one way or another. He was the president of this organization back in 1979, and last year, just before our meeting, while doing something that he loved, which was participating in another professional meeting, he suffered a V-fib arrest and departed us in just a few short days. So henceforth, this lectureship will be named for Dr. Harold Urschel. And we're really delighted that Betsy can be with us today for this inaugural Harold Urschel History Lecture. Even more appropriate, our talk today is to be given by another Texan. Dr. Caselli is the chief of the Division of Cardiothoracic Surgery at Baylor College of Medicine. He was the president of the Southern Thoracic back in 2011 and is well positioned to tell us about E. Stanley Crawford from an historical perspective, because he was there and helped him make some of that history, training with Dr. Crawford, being his junior partner, and carrying on his legacy after he left us. So without ado and without wasting any further of Dr. Caselli's time, I'll invite him to the podium for his talk.
Thank you, AJ. I can't be more honored than to have this opportunity to give the first historical lecture in Hal Urschel's name. I'm going to be talking about one of my mentors, my primary mentor, Dr. E. Stanley Crawford, and try to give you a little bit of a flavor of the man and the times. I have no disclosures for this other than that I like to think of myself, as many of you, a very good friend of Hal Urschel. I got to know Hal through Stanley Crawford. They were both very, very good friends and colleagues, and spent a great deal of time together at meetings and meetings like this, etc. And also, over the years, became very good friends with Betsy Urschel, as many of you are. You know, Betsy, what can you say? She's both charming, warm, compassionate, but also equally accomplished. Betsy, I remember that when Kelly and I got married in 1992 in October, Betsy came down to Houston to be with us for that weekend, and I still remember it very, very fondly. Harold Urschel was enormously accomplished, bigger than life. Words iconic have been used appropriately. And as A.J. pointed out, he was past president of this organization, but also the Society for Thoracic Surgeons, American College of Chest Physicians, the International Academy of Chest Physicians, and, of course, the Texas Surgical Society. Additionally, he was a governor of the American College of Surgeons, chairman of the American Board of Thoracic Surgery, and chairman of the RRC for Thoracic Surgery. We've heard over the years from Hal so many stories. Almost every single time he got up and presented, there would be this kind of hum as he would talk about his football days at Princeton and being on that winning team. We yawn then, but we miss it now. He was president of the STSA in 1979, as A.J. pointed out, but was intimately involved in this society and loved it dearly, as we all do. He had the Tiki Award, the President's Award, the Osler Abbott Award, the Mavrutis Urschel Award, ultimately named, of course, after his name, and then was our organization's historian, and consequently, it is just so appropriate that this historical lectureship be named in his honor. a couple of things about Hal. This is a quote that's been associated with him that you may or may not have heard. Excellence is a result of caring more than others think wise, dreaming more than others think practical, risking more than others think safe, and expecting more than others think possible. So classically, Hal. He presented a couple of years ago and then ultimately wrote the manuscript with Betsy, an iconic individual himself, and talked about a Robert Shaw. And it's in that manuscript, the poem that that Harold so frequently associated with, and attributes this to Shaw, that life is short, art is long, the occasion instant, the experiment perilous, and the decision difficult. Of course, from Hippocrates. It's appropriate, too, because Harold deeply respected and had a great deal of interest in history, wrote a great deal about the history in Dallas and Baylor and other institutions, and had a deep love for the pioneers and the innovators and the people that came before us. But Hal also was bombastic and brought humor to everything, both his talks in the operating room, in his conversations, and I think this would kind of be something that he would recognize down that vein. But my main focus, of course, is E. Stanley Crawford. He affected my life probably more than anyone other than my parents. I spent the last 7 years of his career working side by side with him as one of his juniors. I can't go into all of the details of this man. There's simply not enough time. But I will say that he focused more on the STS, the AATS, the SVS, and the ISCVS, and really not so much on this organization. But he knew how important and influential this group was, particularly with his relationship with Harold, and pushed me to be part of this organization. And I brought our material here for the 34th meeting on brain temperatures and circulatory arrest. I presented this paper for us on the 35th meeting in Florida on composite valve graphs, and then on infection in the following meeting. And this was a reflection of Dr. Crawford's understanding and interest in this particular organization. He was born and lived about 5 to 10 miles outside of Evergreen, Alabama in the pre-Depression years. His father was a farmer who was also a cabinet maker. He could identify nice furniture and virtually replicate it, so Dr. Crawford said they always had nice furniture in their house. They weren't very educated, but like Hal's parents, understood the importance of education and what that can do with lifting the lives of your children and your grandchildren and on down the line. He was educated in a single-room schoolhouse till he went to Evergreen High School. About the time of the Depression, probably because of his father's Scottish wisdom, had finally paid for his home in a surrounding 30 acres. But with the Depression, of course, they had borrowed money for the rest of the farming that they were doing. They lost everything except that 30 acres in their house, which is probably why they weren't displaced and were able to continue to live in Evergreen. Dr. Crawford's first kind of exposure to medicine was during the summers and part-time, he actually worked for a pharmacist who initially tried to get Dr. Crawford to continue to work for him following school, take over the business, and was going to be his protege from there on. But Dr. Crawford, partly through his parents and other influences, et cetera, set his sights a lot higher. This is a plaque that I was actually there for the dedication, which was set up in Evergreen, Alabama, recognizing their very, very important citizen. Dr. Crawford went on to go to the University of Alabama, and then then to medical school at Alabama, and then transferred to Harvard Medical School, where he ultimately graduated in 1946. He then went on to start his residency at the Massachusetts General Hospital, took 2 years out, where he went to the Navy. He was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and then he was back to Massachusetts General Hospital, finishing up his education there, but took a year out, 1951 to 1952, and came down to Houston and spent some time with Dr. DeBakey, went back to finish his chief year and his rest of his education, and then came back to Baylor College of Medicine in 1954 and spent the rest of his career there. He was a past president of the Southern Association for Vascular Surgery, SVS, the Lifeline Foundation, Houston Surgical, the ISCVS, the Michael E. DeBakey Society. This is a picture of Dr. Crawford, 1951, prior to his coming to Houston, as he had just finishing up some training there. He was affected by Arthur Allen, who was interested in vascular surgery, particularly from venous thrombosis and thrombophlebitis, et cetera. But what happened was, is when he left Harvard and came back, Allen was in charge of the East and Churchill was in charge of the West. Allen got sick, so when then Dr. Crawford went back to Massachusetts General Hospital, he was thrown in now working with Churchill, who took over both the East and the West. Churchill influenced a lot of people, and because of his connections during the war, was friends with Dr. DeBakey. Both of them were consultants to the leadership of the war effort on the medical side. But because of Dr. Urschel's relationship there with the MGH, he also was a mentee of Churchill, as was Beecher Sweet, and of course I mentioned Dr. DeBakey. Now, in 1949, basically a few days before Dr. Crawford left the Navy to resume his work at the MGH, he married Carolyn Easter, his Alabama sweetheart, and they began to flourish as a family. I mentioned he was influenced by Dr. Crawford, and here he is in 1951, during that period where he came down for a year. And this is, interestingly, also the same year that Dr. Cooley came to Houston. So it must have been an absolutely fascinating time. Cooley came in 48 to build up Baylor College of Medicine, both from a surgery standpoint, but also from the entire medical school. Cooley came in 51, and then Dr. Crawford finally came to arrive and stay in 1954. And this is a nice picture of him here. He came to a department of surgery, which was a phenomenal accumulation of surgical talent, particularly cardiovascular. You can see some of them here: George Morris, Ostner, Sam Henley, Arthur Bell, Dr. Cooley, and others. Got to remember, 1954, Eisenhower was president, Teflon nonstick pans were just coming out, McDonald's was just being kicked off, Swanson TV dinners were introduced, Godzilla came out as a movie, Monroe married DiMaggio, Elvis was a big hit, and On the Waterfront was a movie. So this is a little bit of the times that we were in. Baylor College of Medicine started out as the first institution in the Texas Medical Center on 140 acres, which was established by the MD Anderson Foundation to actually build a medical center. They knew they needed a medical school, so they were able to bring Baylor, and the Cullen Building, which you see here, was built on a tree area. It's my understanding they used to hunt deer and dove in some of those fields back there. This is what it looked like. In the lower left-hand corner is Herman Hospital. It wasn't part of the initial medical center, but later was annexed as to part of the overall project. They then brought in a Methodist Hospital, which Dr. Crawford and Dr. Cooley and Dr. DeBakey made into one of the major institutions really worldwide. The Texas Medical Center is the largest accumulation of medical facilities really anywhere in the world. Dr. Crawford at this time really didn't know exactly where he was going to head, so he got involved with a fellow by the name of Leota, Domingo Leota, who was working in the lab with Dr. DeBakey developing these pumps. And actually, the first left ventricular assist device was put in by Dr. Crawford. He had a patient July 18th, 1963. He put a Star Edwards valve in. The guy arrested the next day, so he got Leota, and they put this pump out of the lab and then put it in this gentleman, who then died 4 years later. But it was part of a process that was going on, because the next year, the NIH said, we're going to take on artificial hearts. We know how that turned out, like we did the moon. And then in 1966, DeBakey and Liotta implanted the first really successful left ventricular assist device. And then on April 4th, in Haskell Karp, 1969, Dr. Cooley and Liotta planted the first successful artificial heart in man, and then later transplanted and later died. And that's the incident that brought about the feud between Dr. Cooley and Dr. DeBakey. At this time, there wasn't any really decent way of managing aneurysms, but Etheridge in California was credited with doing the first thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysm using a homograft, and then with Dr. DeBakey and Dacron grafts, eventually everything took off. But on the thoracoabdominal, which really was one of the key loves of Dr. Crawford, Dr. DeBakey grabbed onto the idea after Etheridge. They did four patients, two died, 50% mortality. Within 10 years with Dacron, they were replacing everything in the aorta. They became rock stars. They were on the cover of Time magazine, etc. Then he had 42 thoracoabdominal aneurysms with a 26% mortality. This is about the time, and you got to remember that Dr. Cooley was with Dr. DeBakey for 18 years prior to the feud that started in 1969. Let's see what Dr. Cooley has to say about, how do we go back? How can I get this?
As a person, I remember Stanley very much. He and I actually went quail shooting down at the King Ranch here one time, just the two of us, and we had a very enjoyable time. Stanley was a good quail shot. Another thing I remember about Stanley was when I had departed from Mike DeBakey's service, and Mike was and I developed a real feud. Stanley refused to be part of the program to discredit me.
After working with the left assist device and understanding that Dr. Cooley was going to do the upper part of the aorta and Dr. DeBakey the abdominal aorta, Stanley Crawford said, "I'll take on the no man's land in between." So he accumulated 28 patients by this paper in 74 with excellent results. So we've gone from the homograph with the early reports, and then the extra anatomic reconstructions, and finally the Crawford approach for more of an anatomic reconstruction. They were off to the races. They had a 7% mortality. He began to take on things that nobody had fooled with before. It was considered inoperable, replacement of the extensive aneurysms in Marfan syndrome, and even total replacement of the aorta with Dacron grafts. This is when he had 82 thoracoabdominal aneurysms with really a survival rate of 94%. Unbelievable for the time, a really a surgical tour de force. Right when I came on, about 1984, Dr. Crawford had accumulated a large number of thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysms, and he really felt one of the most important papers that he was ever going to put out, he gave at the SVS. He dropped me this little note, you know, just kind of a reflection of how happy he was about it. And it was on 605 thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysms, and it's the paper that outlined the classification for thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysms that we use.
Thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysms are defined as those that involve the descending thoracic aorta and abdominal aorta in continuity.
I'm sorry, that's not playing very well, but I thought maybe y'all would like to just see a little snippet of the gentleman himself. And in this 25-year experience, the results were just absolutely outstanding, with the mortality rate under 10%, with great strides in things like paraplegia in renal failure. Everybody at that time was working extremely hard. Here we are.
Before I came down to work with Dr. Crawford, I actually went into training. I swam and ran, got down to my ideal weight. I mean, I knew it was going to be physically a very grueling year. The year I spent with Dr. Crawford, however, was one of the most intense years I've ever spent in training or even in practice. It was an amazing year. We did about 125 thoracoabdominals that year. And of course, his practice, he did over 1,300 major cardiac and vascular cases. So it was an incredible experience. The other thing that amazed me was how tireless the man was. I mean, I'd call him at 2:30 in the morning with some clinical problem when I was on the floor, and he'd be up writing at 2 o'clock in the morning. Yet he'd show up at 8 o'clock ready to go every day. I don't think I have the physical stamina to do that.
One of his colleagues was Jimmy Howe.
I think he was one of the hardest working men I've ever met in my life. He would, particularly after he started more or less into this thoracoabdominal aneurysm surgery, which he excelled at, and he would work from 7 in the morning till sometimes all night long on these operations, completing them. So to me, he was really a workaholic.
They didn't have things like we did. They had to invent things. A lot of blood was lost on these big operations, and the Cell Saver devices were wholly inadequate. He got together with Lou Fellman at Baylor College of Medicine Machine Shop and David Yawn, a pathologist running the blood lab, and they developed the BRAT, the Baylor Rapid Autotagless Transfusion Device, which they then sold, and it was really the first device of its type. Here's David Yawn.
He had diverse interests. He was a fisherman and a crack shot bird hunter. He reminds me of Da Vinci for his versatility. Da Vinci did everything imaginable, from medical drawings to mechanical inventions. He also reminded me of Osler. He had a magnificent command of the English language. His writing was medical, and scientific writing was impeccable.
He wrote a book with his son John, a vascular surgeon in Fort Worth, and it's as you go around the world, and this book's been out of print for a long time, you'll still see pictures from this book on people's slides. He investigated thoracoabdominal aneurysms like no one before him. We looked at somatosensory evoked potentials. We carried out prospective randomized trials, which you know in surgery is monumental events, particularly in here, one with CSF drainage. The culmination of his thoracoabdominal career was 1,509 thoracoabdominal aneurysms reported after his passing under Lars Svensson. He was an educator. He established and was influential in establishing vascular surgery as a specialty, and the first accredited vascular residency program was under his direction. He was never president. He was never a division chief or a chairman of a department. He did all of this, you know, in the wings without the need for the titles and all the rest of it. In 1987, when he was president of the SVS, he understood that the future of vascular surgery is going to require some intense focus. He helped establish the first critical issues forum at the annual meeting the next year. It had such things as challenges in vascular surgery, training, new technologies, etc. And in 1993, they renamed it the E. Stanley Crawford Critical Issues Symposium. It remains in his name. Despite being bigger than life, he was still human. He consumed on a very, very regular basis Picayune cigarettes. Picayune is a French coin. Times Picayune's a newspaper in New Orleans. It's a small town on the other side of Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans, but it's also a very, very strong tobacco. This extra mild is completely deceiving. The pride of New Orleans in the center there, I'll let you pass judgment on it. It ultimately led to his demise. January 31st, 1991, while in the coffee room outside the operating room, with a cigarette in one hand and a black cup of coffee in the other, he slumped down with a major stroke. He lived till the next year and a half to October before he finally passed away. He recovered from the stroke for a while, was functional for a bit, but was never able to return to work. He got accolades from all over the world. I would just throw in Frank Sinatra and President Ronald Reagan at the time. In addition to his teaching, his education, and the gift that he gave of life to his patients, I think he would probably rate his greatest accomplishment as his family. Clay Crawford, an attorney, John Crawford, a vascular surgeon, Bruce Crawford, another attorney and an investment banker, his lovely daughter, Carolyn. He fished with his family. He hunted with his family. This is with young Bruce. This is later with Bruce, and I can't tell you how many fishing trips they had in between these two. He loved to hunt, and he passed hunting and his love for hunting on to his children. He was primarily a bird hunter, and this is Clay, John, and Bruce in a more recent photograph. Towards the end of his life,
and he said, you know, Lars, when you come to the end of your career, what you're going to look back on is what you've done for other people and how people see you and whether along the way you've made the right choices that have defined you as a good character.
I would have to say that Dr. Crawford made many, many right choices. I just want you, this is just a couple of, this is about a minute from Bruce. He's got some interesting stories and can give you a fabric.
Every day, and I'd ask him not how many operations he was going to do that day, but how many lives he was going to save. It really was amazing that our father could raise four kids under the age of 18 with a busy surgical schedule, writing articles, giving lectures, and being the chief of the medical staff at Methodist Hospital while our mother was hospitalized. My father came from modest circumstances, living out in 5 miles outside of the town of Evergreen, Alabama. And all the doctors that we knew of in Houston owned farms and ranches. And I would ask my dad when I was a kid, Dad, how come we don't have a farm or ranch? And he said, Bruce, let me tell you something. I worked all my life to get off that farm, and I'm not going back. Dr. Staub told me that he and a friend went out south of Houston and got on a John boat with a noose, and they captured a 8-foot alligator, got it into the back of a pickup truck, and in the middle of the night they went to the old River Oaks Country Club pool and put that alligator in the pool and snuck out in the dead of night. And the next day, the country club had to drain the pool. The Houston Zoo came and removed the alligator. And it was the front page headlines of the Houston Post, the Houston Chronicle, and the old Houston Press. And I told my dad that story. And you know what he said to me? He said, you know who that other guy was? I said, no. He said, me. I was amazed, and he said, the only reason I'm telling you that is it's beyond the statute of limitations.
Dr. Crawford was really one of the most, if not the most accomplished aortic surgeon of his era. He established the classification for thoracoabdominal aneurysms we still use. He demonstrated the feasibility of complex aortic repair. And I would say this, we talk about our heroes, our pioneers, and the bravery of these surgeons, but I think Dr. Crawford, in the core of his humanity, would say the real brave person is the person on the table that's going through this process of our learning how to deal with these complex problems, any mentored generations of aortic surgeons. I was a good friend of Dr. Crawford's. He was my mentor. I was a good friend of Hal Urschel's. I hope that I've done both of them justice. Dr. Crawford dearly loved Hal Urschel, and he loved Betsy Urschel. I'm so happy that she's with us here today, and I can't thank the Society for the honor for me personally to have the opportunity to present this first Urschel historical presentation. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Joe. That was terrific. And we'll reconvene at 10:20. Isn't that right? Oh, right now? Right now.
Have we got a change in the invited discussion for Cameron? I'm sure he's not here, right?
What now?
Duke Cameron, is he's not here, is he?
No, he's not.
Which one has a change?
I've got him discussing this paper.
What number?
71?
71.
I don't know.
I don't
have a name.
Okay. I don't know about it.
Well, whatever.
Run out. You know, let me just run out and let the ladies know.
Whoever shows
All right.
up.
Good.
Oh.